This is Daniels for Majority Rights Radio. I have with me Anthony Mitchells and James Bowery, who are going to be discussing the radical economic problems that we are facing and what might be done about it. Following this interview, Anthony will be doing further work with James, helping to sort out his sortocracy, and that will be featured on James' sortocracy site. Anthony will also be joining GW once again to resume discussion of the intersection of economics and politics in our interests. Without further ado, here is James Bowery and Anthony Mitchells in conversation.
So I'm here with Anthony. How do you pronounce your last name?
Mitchells.
Mitchells.
Yeah.
Okay, Anthony, you have some interesting ideas in political economy. And I guess I'd ask you, what is the most important concept in your idea of political economy?
All right, yeah. Well, my work really revolves about around usury. My blog is realcurrencies.wordpress.com, and the mission of the blog is to support people and the Commonwealth by and resisting the money power by defeating usury. And usury is really the foundational ill in our society today. It's really the original sin in the economy, and it is the root cause of all poverty, environmental destruction, plutocracy, which are the key issues nowadays. Usury also finances all the other outrages that we're combating, including mass immigration, feminism, and the destruction of the family. Usury is the method of the banking cartel, and has been a huge plague throughout European history, even in the Middle Ages, when the usury prohibition was for normal people, resulted in very little usury in the economy. Jews were already very infamous for lending at interest, and was a huge societal issue. You can see this in the Quran, where it is constantly, we're just constantly talking about usury, but you can also see it in the Magna Carta, which is, of course, a pivotal document which has two paragraphs on Jewish usury. And Jewish usury later morphed into banking, because banking is nothing else but institutionalized usury. Banking is basically the core of capitalism, because banking and capitalism arose together in Britain and in the Netherlands in the 1600s, 1700s. Banking really was the core of both the Amsterdam Empire and the British Empire. And
well, let me ask for just for a moment to define the boundaries of the concept of usury. For example, in what way does usury differ from economic rent seeking?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, there are a number of definitions for usury in play. The unreal definition is that it is about excessive interest on loans of money. This is what the bankers have later skewed this word to become to mean. But what it really means is interest on loans of money. It is a form of rent and of rent seeking. It is the mother of all rent seeking. For instance, if you have land on rents on housing nowadays, research shows that 75% of the cost of renting housing is usury passed on to the tenant. Usury creates all sorts of issues that enhance rent seeking. Scarce money, for instance, means that people have too little capital to buy instead of rent. It also means that because landlord has been making capital costs himself to buy the house and to finance the whole operation, he must pass this on to the tenant. And this, like I was saying, leads to 75% higher, is 75% of the rents the tenants pay.
Well, so I guess what I'm looking for is the boundary between the concepts, if there is one. So what you're saying is that usury is a form of rent seeking, but it is the major form of rent seeking. Is that correct?
Yeah. Rent seeking is what I consider unearned income, and right. I resist all unearned income. The reason why I focus on money is because money is the ultimate monopoly, the ultimate rent seeker's wet dream, and most other rents build on usury and scarce money, and these are two sides of the same coin.
Well, let me put forth to you a concept of economic rent that is really recent in historic terms. If you take a look at what Bill Gates did to become the world's richest man, he purchased an operating system from a programmer in Seattle, I believe it was, and with the assistance of his mother, who was had an inroad with the board of directors of IBM, was able to then come up with a contract with IBM whereby they would distribute this operating system with their personal computer. IBM, being the biggest name in computing at the time, was therefore distributing Bill Gates's copyrighted MS-DOS with their computer. That meant that anybody who wanted to write software for delivery to the personal computer industry, which was then new, would have to prefer to write it to the MS-DOS operating system. And anybody who wanted to run software that was available, say word processors or spreadsheets, et cetera, would need to acquire MS-DOS in order to run the applications. So this meant that MS-DOS was a kind of a gatekeeper for both the software developers and the software users of the era. And the more people who wrote software to it, the more people would have to buy MS-DOS to be able to write to run that software, and then vice versa. The more people who owned MS-DOS, that meant that people who wanted to write software had to write it to MS-DOS to reach that market. So that's something called the network effect that creates a positive feedback that forces everybody to basically buy this or pay rent to Bill Gates, or in this case Microsoft, where Bill Gates is the primary owner. Now, there's no usury per se involved in this. It's purely the network effect. And another network effect today would be familiar to people would be Facebook, starting with the Harvard. Go ahead.
Can I react to this? Because your case is very clear, very important. And what I'll show to you is that the IBM construct and the market power that they provided Bill Gates with was already a network effect of usury. Because the problem is this, that we are ruled by a banking cartel. Because of compound interest, this banking cartel owns everything, and they also own all the major transnationals. And what happens is that the bankers, they provide credit to and very low-cost credit to their proxies, the transnational corporations, while they do not provide cheap credit to small and medium business. And in economics, the first law of economics is he with the lowest cost for capital wins. And this means that the transnationals, they have always access to abundant cheap capital, whereas a small business has not, and therefore cannot really compete. And this is what has created the market power that enabled IBM to do this with Bill Gates.
Well, if you look at, for example, Facebook, you might say that a similar role to IBM was played by Harvard University, in that the social status of Harvard University was what sort of provided the impetus to make Facebook into the place to be for social contacts and social networking. But there's also a network effect that's independent of the original source. It's a matter of whoever gets into the area the first with the most establishes a positive feedback effect that is very difficult to displace, regardless of its origin. In other words, the fact that MS-DOS originated with IBM's sort of heavyweight launch into the market became unimportant after a very short period of time. It was only a matter of just a few years, and it was very difficult even for Apple Corporation, who had preceded Microsoft into the market, to make headway with the Macintosh against the Windows or the Microsoft de facto monopoly based on the network effect. And at that point, IBM was out of the picture pretty much. So the network effect has its own, at a point, has its own, or I should say, a life of its own.
But I want to add to this. I completely hear what you're saying, and it's completely right what you're saying. But what we have to add to this picture is that Microsoft and IBM and Apple are owned by the same people.
Okay.
So this network effect, and this is a key issue that I keep hammering home in my blog, Real Currencies. Capitalism is one global block. It's all owned by the same few banking families, and that's really crucial to understand. And this has happened because usury automatically implies compound interest, and compound interest means automatically, you can really calculate this easily with a basic calculator, automatically leads to the very rich owning everything within generations. It's unavoidable. The numbers are so huge with exponential growth that within 100 and or 200 years they own everything. And this is also this can be easily confirmed if you you can Google a number of major trust funds like Blackwater or Street Corporation or Fidelity. These are a number of the huge ones. These are owned by a few families, and they have assets of several trillion dollars each, and they own all the major banks, and through the banks they own all the major transnational corporations.
Well, maybe I can come at the usury angle from a bit different angle, since you brought up the difference in interest rates between small businesses and large businesses. The argument that the banker makes is that when he loans to a small business as opposed to, say, an IBM, the loan is less likely to be paid back than it is with an IBM, and therefore he can charge lower interest to the IBM. So in that respect, the argument is that there's a rational reason for these larger entities to be charged lower interest. And so I guess in that respect, isn't there a sort of built-in to the very structure of the economy favoritism from a usury standpoint or from a banking standpoint for the larger entities?
Yeah, because, you know, the bankers have all sorts of explanations why they do what they do, but they're just rationales. They have absolutely nothing to do with reality. The bankers create all the credit that they lend out. They do not lend deposits. They lend freshly created credit. The risk to them is close to zero because in a rational monetary system, all users of the monetary system would mutually guarantee each other's loans and credit rights, and this completely negates any need for usury. Any, there's no need for it at all. There's only a need to pass on real costs for the management of the credit facility, a bit of wages here and there, and a building for these people to work in. But these real costs are just a fraction of usury.
Okay, and well, let's talk about the monetary system then. As I understand, you're making the argument that by basing the monetary system on interest-bearing loans, you're building into the economic structure, into the macroeconomic structure, this centralization of wealth by the process you previously described with the exponential collection of rents, as it were. There's something in modern portfolio theory. I don't know if you're familiar with modern portfolio theory or not, but it's called the risk-free interest rate. Are you familiar with that at all?
No.
Okay. Well, anyway, it's I believe it was out of the Chicago School of Economics, but we can skip beyond that. I'll get into that when I start talking about my theories. Then, what would you say is a good basis for the monetary system?
It is very easy to create a completely usury-free economy, and it can be done in a number of ways. In the first place, you can, like I was just saying, the banks just create the credit that they lend out. They do not lend deposits, but they create a credit. This is basically a cost-free operation, or the costs are indeed very low. Let me give you an example. For a mortgage for $100,000 over 30 years, you will have paid $150,000 in usury, plus the $100,000 principal is $250,000 for a house that is purportedly costing $100,000. The real cost of managing this loan is maybe $10,000. You have to make sure that every month the installment is paid off, and so you need a couple of people to manage the incoming installments. Sometimes you have to liquidate, but there is absolutely zero risk because there is a house as collateral. So the real costs of managing these loans are close to zero, and this means that we can offer an interest-free mortgage to normal people, where you can buy a house for $100,000 and pay $10,000 in real costs over a number of years, and this is how we can create all the money and all the credit for normal people, and not just for the government. This is a bit of a sidetrack. Let me forget about that for a second. But normal people can, in this way, easily be provided with interest-free credit with the current standing of monetary theory.
So how do you underwrite the risk of a default?
There is no risk because there is collateral.
There is no risk because there's collateral in the form of the house, you mean?
Yeah.
Okay, so somebody, a bank loans money to somebody to buy the house, and they don't pay it back, and then you sell the house to recover the money that you were loaning out.
Yeah, and let me also say this, because we are going to provide interest-free credit on the basis of the sheer fact that the credit does not belong to the bank, but to the people that are using the money on which the credit is based. We are not going to go into the debtor who cannot pay and slaughter him like a bloody pig, as is now the way that banks operate. No, we're just going to have a normal chat with this person. What's up? Are you out of work? Are you sick? Or what's going on? If there is a problem that you can't pay for a year or so, we're just going to say, well, then we'll have patience for a year because the debt is not growing because of interest. And there is no interest, so the debt is just on a stable level. And we can manage this. Society has absolutely no interest in slaughtering people. And if somebody is screwing with the credit facility and thinks that he can evade his responsibilities, then you have the opportunity to go in and say, move elsewhere, and we're going to sell this asset so we can settle the debt. And when money remains, then, of course, this comes back to the house owner.
Okay, so there's a some amount of risk, though, in the sense that if you've loaned money out, and then the market value of the house goes down, there's a loss of collateral value, correct?
Well, but this, you know, what you have in the current economy is a boom-bust cycle. So what happens there is that the banks first flood the market with credit. As a result, there is huge inflation, rising prices, assets start appreciating. And then the bankers pop the bubble. You have a huge deflation, a crash in prices. This is attractive to banks because then everybody has to liquidate their assets, which only they can buy up because they're the only ones with money in a deflationary period. This is also going on nowadays because all the defaults in the U.S. housing markets, all these houses are being bought up by Wall Street itself. In the normal fashion. So the banks create the boom-bust cycle, and in a normal, rational monetary system, there is inflation nor deflation, and the housing can always housing prices can be well managed to be simply stable.
Okay, so it sounds like what you're saying is that the monetary base is actually the asset base that's providing essentials of living, like housing. Is that correct?
You mean that the money is basically based on the assets of the society?
Yes.
Yeah, that is exactly what I'm talking about. Okay. There is no need ever for society to be in either too much debt or in a lack of money, because there's always plenty of assets upon which you can create new promises to pay, which is basically what credit is.
Okay, so we have established, I think, a better idea of what your concept of good money would be, which is that as the asset base of the society grows, your money supply grows to keep the value stable and avoid inflation or deflation. Is that correct?
Yeah, indeed.
Okay. The monetary authority, tell me how money enters into the economy.
Simply by lending. So the minute somebody takes out a loan, money is created by bookkeeping, double entry bookkeeping. So at that point, new money comes into circulation, and then the debtor starts paying off the debt. And with every installment, the debt becomes smaller, and the amount of money in circulation also becomes smaller, because when the money is repaid, then the money is also retired.
Okay, so what's happening during a loan process is a banker, presumably a non-usury banker, let's say, determines that there is some increase in the value of society that can occur as a result of this loan, and that's going to be associated. That increase in value is going to take the form of, say, a new building or house, or maybe a business, maybe even an investment in the development of a technology. And as a result of that, the money that's created in the loan is then backed by the asset that's thereby created. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. So I get back to the question about the risk. In other words, let's say, for example, somebody has an idea for a technology they want to develop, and they are financed, and then they fail. What happens to the money?
Yeah. Okay. So this is indeed a bit of a side issue, because for this reason, 90% of all credit that goes out of a credit facility is basically a no-brainer. It's either a mortgage, which is a normal loan and that people should basically be able to get, or it's a business loan. We were not talking about bogus credit card debt and all that sort of kind of bullshit, because that all just needs to go. There's absolutely no need for that. It's only because people are just strapped for cash and it's only a skimming method. The only thing that will remain is mortgages and solid business loans. 90% of business loans are not very exciting. Somebody is just going to open up a printing shop and needs to buy a machine. He can use the machine as collateral, and while he's producing, he pays off the machine and there's no sweat. But then you have also a small segment in business, which is high venture. And this will have to be managed in a separate way. This cannot be done with normal interest-free credit, because as you correctly state, there is no real collateral, so there is risk. This can be best managed with what they call brokerages. People can invest some money and share in risk, but also in the profit. But this would be a small segment of the economy.
When you're financing these riskier things, you're not making loans. What you're doing is you actually have investments. And it's only where you've got, I guess what a banker would call it would be a liquidation value in place liquidation value is, I think, the accounting term for it. You have some asset that if you have to take ownership of it and you want to turn that into money, you want to liquidate it, you have a non-distressed sale, and that non-distressed sale means that you can keep it on the market for some reasonable period of time, say one quarter or something like that, 3 months, and then receive somebody who wants to buy it at a price that you call the liquidation value. And that liquidation value would be the collateral value of the loan. There are situations, however, in which the owner of the, let's say you have a business owner that is particularly good at running the business. They want to take out a loan and they want to buy a variety of things that in combination increase the value. Now, this is the same as, say, developing a new technology, but they may have a new business model of sorts. What you're saying is that the loan that they take out would be strictly on the basis of the components that they're going to purchase that would have a liquidation value that is easily determined by the market. And if they go out of business, then there's no real loss to the economy. So because you can still liquidate these things back into the market at a leisurely pace, but not at a not at a pace that keeps them out of circulation. I think I understand what you're saying about this idea. Do you have any ideas about how one could go about overcoming the power structures that are in place that are obviously going to oppose this kind of thing?
Yeah, well, that's in the next step. I think this is good. I think we have the basic picture of how a monetary system without usury could look. It's, by the way, it's not the only way that you could go about it, but this is the way that I would suggest is the most transparent and direct. But the other question, indeed, is how do you? Because what we're dealing with, my basic take on the power situation in the world is, like I was just describing, we are ruled by a banking cartel. These banking families own everything, including all governments on the globe, and this is then the new world order. So this is not so easy. How do you get rid of a group of people who own everything? The only real way is growing awareness with the people, because if thinking in society does not change, then nothing changes. But obviously, this is not really happening at the moment, although I must say that awareness of also monetary matters is really growing in the truth movement. And it's more and more people are starting to realize that that usury is really at the heart of the matter. But in the meantime, what I would suggest is ultimately that basically the state should create a decent interest-free credit-based system. This should not be too complicated. Not that the state should have to execute everything, but it should provide the organization and the means necessary to do it. But this is not going to happen because the banking cartel controls all governments. But what we can do in the meantime is create alternative currencies like regional currencies or private barter institutions or things like that. And this is already ongoing on the global scale. You have several regional currencies in the United States. For instance, you have the Berkshires in Germany. You have dozens of them. And in Swiss, you have a huge one. In Swiss, you have a barter system based on interest-free credit or close to interest-free credit, which is called the WIR. And this has been in operation since 1934, was founded in the previous Great Depression. And these guys have been in operation for 80 years, and they are turning over 2 billion Swiss francs in their own currency per year. And I think that that is at this point a really very important opportunity for us all, not only to create currencies and with that immediately provide interest-free credit for Main Street, which is very important, because in the current depression that we are going through, it is Main Street that is being starved from credit and cash, and we can alleviate this liquidity scarcity with new interest-free credit, therefore lessening bankruptcies, lessening unemployment, etc., but also showing the way and telling people, and showing people, this is how it's done, it's doable, we can do this today, and we can also do this on a national level.
Well, I think that we're going to be in very much agreement here, because I am the person who owns the countycurrency.org website. So, are you familiar with Bernard Leger's ideas and writings?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Very much so.
And he had a book most recently published with Club of Rome, which a lot of people consider to be part of the problem. But it's talking about a broad range of things, one of which he emphasized was something called the civic. Are you familiar with that concept?
Yeah, that is basically the society, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's very similar to the county currency idea that I had, except I discovered his idea after I had come up with county currency. Basically, it's just you have a local government that issues currency, and it issues it as part of public works of various types, and the public works, of course, have democratic input. Being local, the democratic input is much less likely to be corrupted by central authorities and media manipulation, because you actually walk down the street and you can look these people in the eye.
And throw more bricks if necessary.
Correct. And what you do is then the county government taxes all of the households, basically saying you are required to acquire a certain number of civics. So the unit of currency in Leger's concept is called the civic. You are required to acquire, say, 10 civics per quarter. And as a result of that, people who are paid in civics to do various labors on behalf of the county or the city or whatever the local jurisdiction is, are then enabled to acquire the national currency or whatever the dominant currency is. In my terminology, would be the network effect locked-in currency, such as the U.S. dollar is the world's reserve currency because of that network effect in international transactions. So that was the basic idea of the civics, and it's also very close to the idea that for county currency that I'm currently promoting with the local counties here. So I certainly understand what you're saying about this as being a potentially revolutionary approach that can avoid a lot of the political problems that you have at trying to deal with things at the national level. You do, however, have problems with central banks that, when they see things like this actually taking off, will take action against them.
I'm not sure about that, because this is a worry that you hear from many people. But for instance, the Berkshires have been in operation for years in the United States without any problem. And also in the United States, you can create, for as far as I know, basically every currency that you would like, but you must avoid the impression that it has anything to do with legal tender. That's the main issue.
That's precisely the problem. In other words, with a civic, the local authority, the local government authority, is actually demanding a payment in terms of civics, which means that it's operating as legal tender.
Well, not in a legal sense. No, in a practical sense, you're right. But in a legal sense, legal tender means that you must use it, that you must accept it in the settlements of debts. But a local government can ask for payments in other units if necessary, I think. And this would not imply that it is not in line with legal tender laws.
Well, I hope you're right, because I haven't been able to get the kind of legal advice that I would like to be able to get on this. In fact, we had a in the state of Iowa in the last election cycle, we had at the Republican convention at the state level a resolution that I introduced, which was to declare that county currency would not be taxed at the state level. And in terms of the federal platform, that it would also be untaxed at the federal level. And this was surprisingly violently opposed by certain factions that saw this as being just a very pernicious proposal. It's kind of surprising that when you look at the way Republicans typically are supposed to be for local governance over central governance. But that kind of conflict is going to, I think, really be a bottleneck for trying these ideas out as people just come up with fear, uncertainty, and doubt about the legality of these proposals, at least in the United States. Now, I know that there have been things like, and the Berkshires, do they collect taxes in terms of Berkshires? I don't think they did.
No, it's only business and consumers.
Yeah, well, I've been sort of on the periphery of a lot of these local currency ideas that go clear back to the 1980s and the green dollars, various Letts systems. And one of the things that has been fairly apparent in attempts to get these things going, and I participated in a few of them, is a failure mode that crops up quite frequently, which is if it's not backed by something that is substantial, in other words, rent for living or food, what will tend to happen is you'll get somebody in the community, generally a grocer, that's providing some necessity. And the people who are trafficking in the local currency will tend to spend a lot of that local currency on obtaining the necessity, and then the person offering that necessity ends up with a big pile that they can't get rid of because all they can buy with it are horoscopes and acupuncture and various non-essentials. They can't pay their employees in terms of it. They can't turn around and go to the farmers if they're a grocer and buy any produce with it. So they end up dumping it, and that causes hyperinflation in the local economy. This is actually something that's been observed in multiple local currency systems that are not backed by something substantial. So,
let me get into this, because okay. what you're talking about is the key bottleneck in all interest-free credit-based local currencies or mutual credit-based currencies, say for instance Letts units, etc. And the reason for this is that units that are created on the basis of mutual credit, double entry bookkeeping, that is, they are not convertible to euro or to dollar in your case, and you say they're not backed by something substantial. I'm saying it's not convertible. Say, for instance, in your example of the grocery, if this guy takes in thousands of the local units, but if he can simply convert them back to dollar, then there is absolutely no problem.
And how does he convert them back to dollar?
Well, this is then interesting, because this is actually the core of my my work because besides my blog realcurrencies.wordpress.com, I also run an interest-free credit-based system here in the Netherlands called the Gelre, and I call the system I have devised the Talent. I have created the first interest-free credit-based unit that is also convertible to euro or dollar or pound. That doesn't matter. It depends on the place where you operate it. Simply by creating an online exchange where people can trade the unit.
Okay, so it's got a floating exchange rate.
It has a floating exchange rate, but well managed. There are a few items. In the first place, most units work with, and also my Talent system works with, the basic agreement. One talent is €1 or $1 in your case. So this is the unit of account is the dollar. the talent can be sold for a maximum of 95 cents. And this is then also normal in units which are convertible under normal circumstances. Like, for instance, the Berkshires. The Berkshires have no interest-free credit, but they are convertible to dollars. Simply, they are brought into circulation by selling them. And then they are converted back by businesses who get more than they can spend viably within the network. But this means that the Berkshire always has dollars backing the unit. In my case, there is no dollar backing, but people can sell the talents, the excess talents online for a maximum of 95 cents. And this exchange rate can go down a little, but because there is always the eternal agreement that one unit is $1, once prices start going down, 93 cents, 91 cents, then the discount that you get is really escalating, because at first it's 5%, but then it's already 7% and 9%, and then obviously the demand for the unit grows also.
So how do you control runaway inflation? Do you simply take more of these units out of circulation?
Yes. Well, the main thing is the amount that is in circulation is basically a function of the credit that you have outstanding, because the money supply is all credit based. So if you notice that that there is hyperinflation because there's too much coming to the exchange, that is what would happen in my system. There's too much coming to the exchange and there's too little demand to mop it all up. Then that is a clear sign that there is too much credit outstanding, more than the network can actually handle. And then you must limit the credit limits of the participating businesses. And in this way, you can completely manage the volume of all the money in circulation.
So in limiting the credit that's available, there becomes a demand for money. In other words, the monetary unit that you're creating, there's a higher demand. And the way that you change the price of that is not through interest rate, which would be normally the case. You say, well, we have a greater demand for dollars to be loaned, so we'll charge a higher interest rate. How do you respond to the greater demand for loans?
Yeah, question. Indeed, in the current system, we have this is managed by interest rates. Rising interest rates means lower demand for credit and therefore less lending and declining money supply. In our system, it's we manage it differently. We go from the basic idea that everybody has a certain right to credit and it must be shared in a reasonable fashion, not equally, because that simply doesn't work. But in a reasonable fashion, and we need to balance the rights of the individual for credit and which is most beneficial for the network.
Okay, so the job of the banker is essentially doing an establishment of credit worthiness with an understanding that if you're not operating under a usurious system, that a greater range of people will qualify for credit worthiness to be able to get into a situation where they can apply their talents to create value for the economy, is my understanding what you're saying.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Very much so, yeah.
Okay. Well, how's things been going? Has it worked?
Well, I've just opened up, and my huge problem here is, and this is also a widely recognized problem within this business, how do you finance your operation in the early phases? And I have been investing a fair bit of money in creating all this and designing the software, doing huge research to try to understand why interest-free money is at this point not yet the norm. And the problem that we are discussing, that the grocery is getting too much of it, and how do you solve that problem? How do you get around this? This has never been really solved in our business, and my proposals are then the next step. But I have great problems keeping going because of lack of money. So that is my bottleneck, and I'm at this point busy creating a crowdfunding initiative because I need a little money to get going, and that is where I stand at the moment. But
well,
I have the whole system.
I asked Barnard Lerter what software he would recommend for the Civic, at least, and he said actually there's a group in Tucson, Arizona, they're starting a C3 model, which I think is similar to the Swiss model you were talking about. They're using payservices.com. Have you heard of them?
Pay Services? C3 is from Stroh in Utrecht.
Which is actually
also in the Netherlands, but Stroh works is also the developer of Cyclos software.
Right, and but I think that they're, he said they have decided to use pay services, what Bernard later says. Oh. So I'm right. kind of surprised that perhaps Cyclos just fell behind. I know I looked at Cyclos about a year ago, and it was kind of difficult to configure for my purpose in county.
Yeah, it is difficult to configure. Absolutely, it is very difficult to configure.
So I just, you might want to look into pay services and see what they've got to offer to make things easier. Okay, well, maybe what we should do at this point is let me start expounding my ideas, and then we can talk about the differences and how. And I wanted to get on to the general topic of certocracy, which is how one can conduct different experiments in a most optimal way and make it so that people have a choice of the kind of political economy in which they live. And not just political economy, but also social theories in general. My views are actually, as you probably can tell, very close to yours in a lot of ways. I have tried to create a unified monetary base that also includes a notion of citizens' dividends that are paid out as the economic rent of society is collected and then distributed evenly to all members of society, or a particular society. And the way it works is, just as in your case, you have to have a some kind of an assessment of a liquidation value for collateral for all of the assets in the economy that provides the basis of the monetary unit. There's a particular mechanism by which that assessment is done, and it's a market-based assessment. I haven't worked out all the details of this, and there are some problems that maybe you could help with conceptually if it sounds like it's meshing with your ideas. But basically the way it works is you have a escrow account for every legally recognized asset in the economy. The philosophical basis for this, I should say, is really rooted in some of the writings of Lysander Spooner about the legitimate form of government being a mutual insurance company. In other words, someone is born into society, and you're going to be imposing upon that person a set of societal norms and rules as a consequence of asking them to leave behind their natural right to initiate force to acquire their essentials of life, including the ability to sire children and raise them to a viable adulthood that's equal to themselves. You have to offer them something. And what I'm suggesting that you offer them is a share, a membership in this mutual insurance company that is there to protect property rights that could not exist in the state of nature where everyone's engaging in essentially single combat to obtain their natural resources, just as you have in other sexual species. So the particular form that this mutual insurance company takes, where you're underwriting the existence of property rights that wouldn't exist in a state of nature, is each person gets a share in a mutual insurance company of which they're a part. And that share also is associated with a dividend payout, just as any share in a corporation has dividend payouts. If it's the kind of corporation that is relatively stable and has a stable cash flow, like an insurance company would tend to have, and also mutual insurance companies do have these kinds of payouts as well. So what you do is you do an assessment of the value of the assets in the economy so that you can have a monetary base. And the way you do that assessment is there is, for every declared asset, just as you would with an insurance company declare the assets you want protected, you declare assets that you want to be legally recognized, there is an escrow account. That escrow account has bids for that asset placed by other people in the economy. So you have a market mechanism to do your assessment. The fact that there's a bid in escrow is, by definition, a liquidation value for that asset. So now you have no problem in banking, in central banking authority trying to determine the liquidation value. It's a market-based liquidation value assessment. If you have more than one bid for a given asset, then the high bid is the one that is applicable, and all of the other bids that are in escrow that are lower are charged a demurrage or an insurance fee that is equivalent to the insurance fee that you are going to charge to all of the assets in the society. So if I've got, say, a house, and the high bid for that house is $200,000, I pay what amounts to an insurance premium or an asset tax, if in more conventional terminology for government, at that assessed rate. The interest or the rate of taxation or the rate at which I pay the insurance fee is the risk-free interest rate under modern portfolio theory. That's also another way of thinking about the risk-free interest rate is the interest rate on the national debt that would be applied in most sovereign currency situations, or the long-term average of that interest rate at which you borrow short-term securities for the sovereign debt. So you have a tax rate, basically you have a net asset tax, the rate of which is the risk-free interest rate. You have an assessed value that's market-based rather than having some kind of, say in France, they have an asset tax where the taxing authorities will go in and they'll negotiate with the asset owner what the value is going to be. And of course, that opens things up for corruption and all kinds of favoritism as opposed to a market-based system. So there's a dynamic that's created by this. There's no taxation on any economic activity. All economic activity is risk-free. I mean, it's tax-free, rather. It's not charged any kind of taxation or fee by the government. And all the taxes that are collected that don't go directly into the operation of maintaining the escrow system are distributed evenly on a quarterly or on a monthly basis, rather, to all of the citizens in the society. And from that, you provide the market demand for social goods out of the citizens' dividend. You issue currency and also fail to issue currency to keep the value of the currency stable by adjusting the citizens' dividend. So you can actually pay out more in the citizens' dividend or less, depending upon whether you've got an inflation or deflation going on. So that's the general outline of the political economy. I just would like to get your opinion on that.
Yeah, well,
that's really interesting. And what I hear, you know, there are a lot of things that I can really relate to in this line of thinking. And one of them is that indeed, we all have a stake in the in society, and we also have a basic right, in fact, to income that is generated by, for instance, what I would call the commons, or what is classically known as the commons. I'm going to give you an example of my thinking and then
That's
relate
fine.
Back to what you're explaining. Yeah.
Good.
So, for instance, what I would like to see is we also need land reform, and one way of land reform would be the admission that private property of land is impossible, because nobody has created the land. Everybody is born into the land, and we all have to share it together. So society owns all the land. We own it together. No, not the state owns it, not corporations, not individuals, but we own it together, and we have a right to a plot of land. We pay for this land so we can have a market situation. So there's simply the market decides what the land costs to rent. But all the rent is then put into one big fund, the societal fund, say, and this fund pays out equal shares to all citizens in the community so that everybody has an income from land, and this income he can use to rent land. And if he wants to live higher up, he must pay a little more, and this will end up with those who pay who want low rents and pay less than they have an income through land. This is a little bit comparable in the sense that there is the admission that we all have to do this together, and that we all have rights in this society, and that we're not stupid slaves of some monopolists who own the whole thing and to whom we are indebted and are paying rents.
This is very reminiscent of Henry George's proposals for land tax and then citizens' dividend.
It is close to it. It is not exactly the same thing because Henry George allows the state to take in this as taxation and then fund state activities with it. So it's not being really returned to the people itself. But which
well,
he did
have a notion for citizens' dividend. But I guess what you're saying is that there was not as strict a requirement as of a distribution of the majority of the funds.
Exactly. That's a good point. Yeah. But this is I think that the values, the underlying value of what I was just describing is very similar to yours, huh?
Yes, we're both trying to look at not just gold or the corn that's stored in the bins, or in Bernard Leiter's notion of a demurrage-based currency. I can't remember the name that he used for it, but he would have a basket of goods that would be, say, lumber and grain and a variety of other things that you could build up inventories of to be countercyclical as a basis of your currency. Instead of doing it that way, you take all assets and essentially turn them into the basis of your currency, which seems to be the right way to do things for an economy. And this is what, in essence, the Federal Reserve is sort of claiming they're doing, but they don't make it so clear that they're talking about basing the money supply on the asset base of the society, because I think if they started doing it in those terms, it would become much clearer that the proper tax basis would be assets rather than activities.
That's a very important point, of course. Eh?
They want to stay away from that.
That is the key issue in your proposal. Eh? So that taxation is based on assets and not on income and consumption.
Yeah, well, all economic activities are untaxed. If you want to get into things like, let's say you're polluting something, rather than trying to minimize pollution through taxation, what you do is you minimize pollution through a variety of other means, including tort laws, for lawsuits and fines, and et cetera, things like that. You don't call them taxes. You don't call them use fees or anything like that. Basically the only thing that you can call or that would be even approximate a tax would be the asset tax, but it's really a use fee for the services of the society to protect your value or protect your property rights. Basically, you're saying to the young man who wants to get together with a young woman and who fall in love and form a family, you're saying you've got to respect the property rights of Ted Turner that owns 1 million acres. You can't just move on to his land and set up housekeeping there. And what we give you in exchange for that respect is the citizen's dividend that allows you to rent that land from Ted Turner or whoever. Yeah. And so you have a natural right to that.
Yeah. Well, I can't really get all the nuances yet because we're only talking a few minutes, but it's very much according to the line of thinking that I have myself. So
okay. Well, I'm sure that there are still some differences in implementation. We may be very close in philosophy, but of course, even if you're close in philosophy, the actual implementation may differ, but you have different ideas about how to implement it. And I'd like to talk a little go ahead.
I think the basic commonality here is that what is happening is that we are no longer taking either through usury or taxation, but also another issue is artificial scarcity through monopoly. We're preventing that, and instead of saying, "Oh, it's grand that everybody pays tax because we are the state," no, the added value of things is going to be returned to the people themselves. And
right.
Everything is the economic power is decentralized, and the net effect of this is, and I think that this is a very important point, is that all people are producers. We are either workers or entrepreneurs, and so we all produce stuff. And what we want to see is that the added value of each and every man's and also woman's production is with the worker or the entrepreneur, and not with a capitalist, not with the state, not with monopolists. And we want people to have full control of what they produce themselves. And that is what these proposals, what your proposal very much achieves.
And one of the things about a society like this is that you still have, since you are sending all of the revenue out to the people, you still have a requirement to fund or somehow support what amounts to national defense. Now, the Swiss have an interesting approach where they basically have every able-bodied man equipped with a military-grade weapon with which they train on a regular basis. And that seems to be a reasonable model to follow if you're going to try to decentralize the government revenue, trying to decentralize the training and ownership of the military equipment seems like an appropriate approach. And the Swiss certainly have a history of successful defense of their territory, even despite the fact that they have different languages, you know, French and German and Italian spoken in their within their borders. So it's I think the Swiss are a very good model to follow in respect to that. And that's one of the things that I would tend to try to emphasize with this kind of thing, which is, okay, so as a member in this mutual insurance company, you have an obligation to come to the defense of the property rights, including the national property rights of the land of the mutual insurance company, which is essentially a land trust mutual insurance company. And in that respect, whenever you receive this dividend, it's coupled with a requirement that you spend it to acquire certain standardized military equipment so that you have a well-regulated militia in the terms that were used in the founding of the United States. Well-regulated meaning well-equipped militia that is also trained with that equipment to appropriately utilize it. And then there would be requirement for reserve training on an occasional basis to come to the defense not only of the country itself but also potentially to form posses for criminal prosecution and enforcement, as was the case in the Old West of the United States. It would frequently be people would be frequently deputized in the community to form posses to go after gangs, etc. So do you have thoughts about law enforcement and national defense in the regard to the distribution of the revenues from the monetary system you're describing?
Well, you know, I'm also very much for a national militia, and basically also based on the Swiss model. And it has the advantages that you were explaining. It also has a very serious advantage that a national militia is not very typically used for imperialist adventure. And if a national militia is attacked from outside, then there will be a very natural and strong motivation by all the able-bodied men to come together and do their national duty. But these men will not be very motivated to go someplace else, 1,000 miles away, and to brutalize people in the name of profits for some maniacs running the whole operation.
Right.
So this is a very important issue also. And of course, a national militia is almost unbeatable. That's also a very important reason why you want to have a national militia. No country can really be taken over by another country that is armed to the teeth and that is defending its own streets with its own militia. That's hard to do. At the very least, you can say it's always a price that nobody will be willing to pay. So I think that a national militia is really the way forward, quite simple.